We have a free market economy, don't we? Loosely regulated capitalism is embedded deep in the self-conception of America. But it's not hard to see that our markets have never really been immune to government interference. Just in the last couple of decades, we've had two major federal bailouts of the U.S. economy. And even free market enthusiasts grant that capitalism occasionally needs rescuing. So why does the idea of a free market have such a hold on us? To really understand, we need to go back to the beginnings of the concept, which stretch back at least as far as ancient Rome, as explained by Jacob Saul in his new book, Free Market: The History of an Idea. Jacob is a professor at the University of Southern California and the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant. Here he is to share five big ideas from the book.
Hi, my name is Jacob Saul, author of Free Market: The History of an Idea. This is the story of how humans have quested for a perfect economic system for millennia, but have often found it's a lot harder to achieve than philosophy would have us believe. I wrote this book because I'm amazed that people think that we can have a system that just works on its own. And people really do, and I respect that. But as a historian, that amazes me, and I thought it was really, really interesting. We have market crashes, we have market failures, but there's this belief in economic philosophy and belief that many hold strongly to, that we can reach what's called general equilibrium, that if we just find this state of market freedom, the market will just work on its own and we don't have to do anything else to have it work, and it'll just produce wealth. And that idea really interests me, and the attachment to that idea. People have been losing faith in it, so I thought that it was a really relevant topic. Insight one, Cicero's origin story. Many people think that free market thought starts with Adam Smith. I'm an intellectual historian, so what I do is I read these old books and I look at them for clues, like a detective, to try and understand where they came from, to try and understand their genealogy, kind of like a DNA test. And with Adam Smith, who's considered the father of economic philosophy, I found that he was a Ciceronian. That meant that he was a professor of moral philosophy, and that everything he did harked back to the Roman philosopher and senator Marcus Tullius Cicero. It was his guide to Stoic philosophy. Cicero was the sort of basis for everything that he did. And so I went back and I started reading Cicero to see why Smith was so interested in Cicero. And what I found was that Cicero not only has a really strict moral Stoic code about behavior, about what it takes to be a good person, but he has really clear ideas on how perfect exchanges between friends, people who really care about each other, can create a perfect market. And so the first idea of a perfect exchange comes from Cicero. And I found that really interesting. And what I did as a historian is I used my nose and I went back and I started looking through all these economic texts, whether they be from the early Christians, the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, the 19th century, and really until 1850, I found that almost every major thinker who thought about markets and how to make them work well relied on Cicero. And I thought that was pretty cool. And it really shows how deep the traditions are that we work with and that we live with and that we rely on, whether we know it or not. Insight two, Christians were the first market thinkers. This is a funny one, and there's been some research done on this, which most people haven't seen, and I fell upon it almost by accident by meeting one of these researchers. And what I found was that Christians were really interested in replacing Cicero, first of all, and saying, look, friendship and serving the state are not what's going to save you. What you need to do is exchange all your wealth. You need to exchange earthly pleasures, sex, food, material pleasures for salvation. It's an exchange. And they literally described salvation as a market exchange that could be perfect. If you're willing to give up earthly goods, then you can have the treasure of heaven. And the early fathers of the church, John of Chrysostom, St. Ambrose, St. Augustine, all talked about salvation in terms of a perfect exchange. And I thought that was really, really fascinating. And it provided a language for economics. In fact, St. Augustine is the first to use the term an invisible hand. And he doesn't use it the same way Smith does, but there's this idea that once you, of good and free will, give away your goods and your pleasures, the hand of God, which you might not be able to see, will bring you into heaven, which is a place filled with rewards and treasures. And they say this in relation to Christ, because they say Christ exchanged his blood for human salvation like a merchant would make an exchange. These are the words of the fathers of the church. I was stunned by this. I had no idea that Christians had sort of changed the Jewish tradition and made it more transactional. And one of the things I do recommend doing is going back to these texts, and I list them in my book, from the Gospels to the Fathers of the Church. There's this remarkable language of exchange and markets going on in early Christianity. But I found something else too that was really neat. And that is that the first people to look for what we might call market mechanisms. So a market mechanism is an idea of supply and demand, or the law of diminishing returns, the idea that the more you have of something, the less it's worth. So there are these automatic things that happen, and those are sort of market mechanisms. The first thinkers in the West that I found that looked for these market mechanisms were Franciscans. The Franciscans were monks who took a vow of total poverty. And their fear was if they didn't live in total poverty and broke their vow, they committed a mortal sin and would be sent to hell. So they had to understand wealth. So they had to understand if the jacket they were wearing was wealth or it was just utilitarian. If owning books, which was very expensive in the Middle Ages, was a material object or something that was just for spiritual study. So they started trying to study value and wealth, not to become rich, but to actually protect their own vow of poverty. So from the Gospels to the early Christian fathers to the Franciscans, this deep interest in markets was actually about poverty. And I thought that's really, really fascinating. And it's not necessarily what we'd think. And in fact, some of these thinkers were central to scholastic thinkers who would come up with early market ideas about the value of money, and that you couldn't just assign a value of money, that money had to do with how much money is in circulation, how quickly it's circulating. This is the quantity of money theory, a major, major fundament of market thought. And these guys and Christianity and the earliest Christianity and the Gospels were at the base of all this. And I think that's just absolutely fascinating.
Insight 3, Colbert builds a market.
There's this guy named Jean-Baptiste Colbert. He is a French minister of Louis XIV, and he's considered by economic historians to be the antithesis of free market thought. Well, it just so happens that I am an expert on Colbert, and I've spent probably 15, probably more, I don't want to admit it, 15 years in Colbert's archives, which means I've just been sitting reading this guy's thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of letters, papers, reports, philosophical or semi-philosophical works. And one of the things I knew from sitting in those archives is that Colbert was not against free markets. In fact, he talked about free markets and that they were ideal. But Colbert felt that France was not as developed as its richer neighbor Holland and its neighbor England. He felt that in order for France to have free and fair exchange, France would have to develop first. That meant it had to develop its industrial base, it had to develop its weights and measures, its roads, its transports, its commercial laws, and it also had to get a good diplomatic corps for trade treaties. I think many of us know that trade treaties are really key. If you write a good trade treaty, it can help your country. If you write a bad one, it can do damage. So Colbert thought, look, I need to build a market, and I also need to build trust in France. So he started sponsoring science when modern science was really being born, and he tried to connect it to the state so that people would trust France because of its good scientists and therefore trust its products. So what I found is the guy who's supposed to be against free market thought was actually a guy who was a real visionary about market building and what it takes to have functioning competitive international markets. And so that overturned one of the major assumptions of economic history. And again, that is always something that interests me, is finding something that we all sort of, or that many people perceive as a given truth, and finding out it might not be as true as we think. Insight 4, the first free market reform. It turns out the first person in a government to ever say, look, I'm going to liberalize the economy, was a French minister named Turgot. And Turgot is really interesting because he was a philosopher, a French philosopher of the Enlightenment. He believed in personal liberty. He believed in the abolition of slavery. He believed in certain rights. He believed in science. He believed in progress. And he believed that France, which was a feudal country with all these medieval tolls and taxes, and nobles didn't even have to pay taxes. So the richest people in the country paid no taxes. Everything that you did had a kind of state oversight. And the state actually also meant nobles. It meant ministers. It meant these powerful lords that controlled everything, to crossing bridges, to using ovens for bread. Turgot's idea was that he needed to liberalize the grain trade. French were having famines and they lived on a subsistence diet. And he said, look, the grain trade needs to expand. And the only way it can expand is if it's liberalized. And he tried the first experiment in the 1760s in a poor region of France. And to do it, he liberalized, but he also built poorhouses. He imported grain for the poor, but just simply because there wasn't enough. He tried to build industry, and he tried to make the tax system fair and proportional so it didn't fall on poor people. He thought that if poor people could get more money, it would spur the economy by inspiring more consumption. So he does these first reforms, and he also founds these really famous local industry, and the state founds them. So there's state intervention and liberalization at the same time, and it's successful. It moves in the right direction. But he's also an idealist, and he really just believes in the idea of freedom. And when he becomes Controller General of Finance, which is like Minister of Finance for Louis XVI in 1774, he moves to Paris and he decides he will just liberalize the grain trade. And people say to him, look, there's been a bad harvest and you've also given up our grain reserves, our strategic grain reserves. France had those. That was part of how the state kept people alive during times of dearth. And he said, not to worry, I'm just going to free the market and it will take care of itself. And he frees the grain market. There's speculation, there's shortages, prices go through the roof, there's wild inflation, there are riots, there's violence, and the country goes up into a kind of what are called the flower wars, a pre-revolutionary anarchy. He becomes convinced that it's a conspiracy and he takes rioters in. These rioters are butchers and rat poisoners and agricultural laborers and Whig salesmen. These are the kind of low and working classes, and they can't get enough bread. They're starving. They're being completely ruined, and they're rising up. He starts torturing people, wondering why his system doesn't work. He wants this perfect system, and he can't get it. And so he thinks it's a conspiracy. It just ends literally in France becoming a sort of pre-revolutionary country. It crystallizes opinion against the state. Many poor people organize against the state. It turns into something really dangerous. And he's finally fired 2 years later in 1776. And the whole experiment goes down the tubes. And I just think it's really fascinating. Whether one is for or against really hardcore shock therapy, free market reforms, this was the first one, and it didn't turn out so well. However, if one looks back at his first reforms, which are very thoughtful, they take into account the needs of society and the realities around him. They were not so ideological. They were more pragmatic. One can see that they work better. And I just think it's a fascinating story and a great parallel that allows us to think about today, showing again that while history doesn't repeat itself, we can learn a lot from the past. Insight 5, the strange modern journey of general equilibrium. Modern free market thinkers really want to believe that if you just free the market, it'll work. And I'm interested in the journey of these thinkers like, you know, Milton Friedman. And what sort of shocked me was not only how idealistic they were, and I really admire this, and I admire their technical economic work, but that also they kind of got themselves in bed politically with some dark forces. And this idea of total freedom ended up being connected to segregation, ended up being connected to what I would call forces of reaction, of reactionary thought. And I thought that in itself was fascinating. A lot of people might not want to hear it, but it is an interesting thing for a philosophy that's based on this very idealistic concept of economic freedom, that it would go into some dark and strange places. Doesn't mean that parts of it don't work. It doesn't mean that it's not all bad, but it just goes to show you that the ideas we have often evolve and move around in ways we don't always imagine that they will. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jacob. That was Jacob Saul with five big ideas from Free Market, The History of an Idea. For another deep dive into the mysteries of capitalism, check out our book bite for Price Wars, How the Commodities Markets Made Our Chaotic World by Rupert Russell. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.